Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Great Integral Awakening Series. My name is Claire Zammit, and in addition to being one of the presenters in the series, I'm also on the board of Integral Enlightenment, the organization producing this event. We're so excited that nearly 7,000 people have signed up so far, with more joining us every day. We want to thank our co-hosts at Integral Life and 8 co-sponsors for all of their support. I'm here this morning to introduce you to Integral Enlightenment founder Craig Hamilton, who is the visionary behind this groundbreaking series. Craig will be hosting each event over the next 14 weeks, alongside the different luminaries who will be sharing leading-edge insights about the future of spirituality. Each week, he'll be introducing the series, the presenter, and engaging in dialogue for about the first hour of the call before opening up for questions. Today's presenter is Michael Murphy, who will be speaking about integral transformative practice and the evolution of the whole person. If you have any questions for Michael, simply send us your question via instant message in the teleseminar window on your computer or dial the conference line number and wait until we ask for a question from someone in your region of the world. Given the volume of people attending, it will probably be easiest if you send your questions via instant message, but we'll try to take some live phone calls and see how well this works. Integral Enlightenment founder Craig Hamilton is a pioneer in the emerging field of evolutionary spirituality. His inspired writings, talks, and teachings call us to awaken beyond the confines of the separate ego and dedicate our lives to further the evolution of consciousness itself. Craig began his spiritual journey in the ashrams and monasteries of the East, but it was his liberating encounter with an authentic Western teaching of enlightenment that provided the catalyst and container for his own transformation. For 13 years, he lived and worked in a dynamic living laboratory of evolution under the direct guidance of enlightened next founder and spiritual teacher, Andrew Cohen, ultimately playing a key role in the leadership of his thriving international spiritual community. He served for years as an inspirational and guiding force in the spiritual lives of practitioners around the world. In his current work, Craig integrates decades of intensive spiritual practice with insights gleaned during his 8 years as senior editor of the award-winning What is Enlightenment magazine. Through his writings and teaching, he is helping to articulate an authentic evolutionary mysticism and integral enlightenment which illuminates the vital relationship between individual transformation and collective evolution. He outlines the principles and practices of this new evolutionary spiritual path in his forthcoming books, The Future of God and Integral Enlightenment. Craig is a founding member of Ken Wilber's Integral Institute and participant in the Synthesis Dialogues, a 35-person interdisciplinary think tank presided over by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. A master in the art of spiritual dialogue, his celebrated conversations with other luminaries are regularly heard by New Dimension's 7 million listeners. He's also a frequent contributor to The Shift magazine and co-author of ION's 2008 Shift Report, co-writer and story editor of the forthcoming documentary film, The Shift. Craig lives in Berkeley, California, where he offers instruction and guidance in meditation and other aspects of evolutionary spiritual practice. So welcome, Craig, and I know I speak for all of us when I say how much we're looking forward to this exciting series over the next 14 weeks.
Thanks, Claire. It's a lot to live up to there, but I'm delighted to be starting out this series today with Mike Murphy, one of my longtime heroes, and really, I think for a lot of us, just someone we all regard as one of the great pioneers of spirituality in the West, period, and particularly evolutionary and integral spirituality. And I'm also excited to have so many people on this series. We originally thought we were going to get about 2,000, and now we just went over 7,000 this morning. So I think why I'm so thrilled about that, in addition to just knowing we've had such a successful event, is just the sense that so many of us are asking these same questions and interested in being part of this collective exploration. So We're going to get to Mike in just a couple of minutes, but before we do, I wanted to just share a little bit with you about the vision behind this series and for my own work at Integral Enlightenment, which is really very tied to the theme of the series, and also just what we're going to be talking about over the next several months together so you can get a sense of the big picture that we're diving into. The vision for all this really, for me, began to dawn about 5 years ago, and it happened. It was kind of an interesting convergence in my own life back in 2004 between two different events that happened almost back to back. The first was called the Synthesis Dialogues, and it was a sort of high caliber spiritual social think tank with about basically 30 spiritual, evolutionary, kind of social change leaders from around the world, including the Dalai Lama himself and a bunch of other what we might call kind of traditional spiritual giants. There were a few non-traditional spiritual leaders there, like Michael Beckwith, Mark Gaffney, and myself, but most of them were what we might think of as progressive traditionalists. And the thing is, I don't know, you may share this sentiment. I know a lot of us have this sense that if we could only get a lot of really powerful, great spiritual leaders together in the room talking, some incredible thing would happen, and it would be a catalyzing event for human consciousness. I know I sort of had this idea going into this event, and yet after a week together, I have to say I left the event feeling like not a whole lot had really happened. And that's not to take anything away from all the individuals involved, because the truth is these were beautiful human beings. No matter who was speaking at any given moment, there was some kind of powerful transmission in the room. There was depth. There was, you know, real spiritual practice in all of these people, and you could feel it. But the topic that we had gathered to speak about was called the courage of evolutionary leadership. And the truth was, most of the people there were not really rooted in an evolutionary worldview and didn't have a lot to say about the topic. So it more ended up being people sort of just sharing kind of beautiful insights from their own traditions about that didn't necessarily have a whole lot to do with where we are now, where we're going, and what we're trying to lean into. So I left that event just kind of with this question of how much do the traditions and the wisdom of how much does the wisdom of the past have to tell us about where we are and where we're going? Right on the heels of this, I had been invited to host a panel discussion at the 2004 Parliament of the World's Religions in Barcelona on a topic which was the future of religion. So it was pretty timely. And as I went to that parliament, where it wasn't just a gathering of 30 luminaries, but of thousands of spiritual practitioners and devotees and disciples, et cetera, from around the world, which also had the promise of being this catalytic event for spirituality. And yet at the end of that, there was this similar kind of feeling like, wow, this was a really sweet event. It was beautiful to feel the kind of unity between faiths that are often at war. But there wasn't any sense there that we were leaning into the future and people might say this is maybe an arrogant thing to say, but I didn't feel there was anything cutting edge about it. And, you know, in the biggest sense, in the sense of what from a spiritual perspective and where we're really trying to go as human beings confronting a world that's, you know, dealing with, you know, frankly, a level of change and challenge that humans have never had to face. So both of these events just put me into this inquiry about, you know, where is humanity going in its spiritual development? Because I think when we step back and take the sort of 30,000-foot view on things, we see that we're in a really interesting and unique time for what we might call humanity's collective spiritual development. Here in the contemporary West, we seem to be in the midst of a kind of spiritual renaissance. There's a groundswell of interest in all things spiritual. We've got a convergence of the global wisdom of the world now available at our fingertips. And we have an unprecedented amount of time on our hands suddenly to pursue our own transformation and evolution, which is itself really a new thing. And at least, you know, some of us do, those of us who have cultivated the leisure in our lives to be able to do that. And I think even more importantly, many of us now are waking up to a kind of new spiritual impulse to participate in the evolutionary process in a conscious way. this impulse to help move evolution forward consciously is a really new thing, and many people are excited about it. So we have this great sort of spiritual opportunity and potential, and yet we're in what seems to me a very interesting predicament. And I'll try to kind of lay it out as briefly as I can. But the way I see the predicament is that the overwhelming majority of genuine wisdom that's available to us is deeply rooted in the ancient past. And now when I say wisdom, I mean understanding of the human condition that's really sourced from a deep and authentic spiritual practice, experience, and insight. And that wisdom may have served humanity for thousands of years, but we have to recognize that human life didn't change all that much over the past few thousand years until very recently. And recently it's changed enormously. So the great traditions emerged at a time when life was radically different than it is today. For one thing, the traditions all grew up in a pre-evolutionary worldview and have not yet really even deeply embraced the insights of evolution, which, you know, as many of us know, really change everything. Also, you know, we don't have to look far to see how dramatically the world itself has just changed in the past 100 or so years. And there's something that maybe is not quite so apparent to us, which is that human beings have also changed dramatically in the past couple thousand years, certainly, but even in the past, you know, couple hundred years, even the past few decades, the experience of being a person, not just our life circumstances that we find ourselves in, but our actual interior has really evolved and developed. And this is one of the insights from cultural evolutionary theory, developmental theory, is that we now have a kind of interiority and self-awareness that even a few generations ago was unheard of. And we also have a kind of relational intimacy with each other that's really a new thing. And again, when we're sitting here in our lives, we're not so aware of how it used to be, but it really was not at all like it is now, due just the experience of being alive. So in a sense, we've got wisdom, but it wasn't created or birthed really for people like us living in a world like the one we're in. And so there's a question facing all of us, which is, you know, we kind of recognize now that for the world to change in a fast enough and large enough way, we really need to evolve ourselves and our consciousness, our deep habit structures. Yet it's not at all clear whether simply pursuing traditional practices and paths will be sufficient to meet the evolutionary challenge of our moment in history. And the last thing I want to point out about this is that a lot of people recognize that spirituality and religion needs to be brought up to date, but if we look at what's largely taken the place of tradition in the lives of contemporary Westerners, contemporary practitioners, it's often some sort of what Houston Smith called cafeteria spirituality. There's sort of this smorgasbord of spiritual options available to us, and the sort of new postmodern way to pursue your spiritual path is to sort of pick and choose between those practices that feel good to you, and then just create your own path out of, you know, a little Kabbalah, a little Vipassana, a little, you know, psychotherapy, whatever it is, and that's sort of the new alternative. And of course, as has been pointed out by many, the challenge with that is that it's not necessarily a time-tested recipe for transformation, and it's an assumption that sort of just doing whatever sort of practices feel good is going to really bring about the kind of radical spiritual transformation that we're seeking for. And this is really an untested hypothesis at this point. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is that I feel that this conundrum brings us to potentially a real threshold moment and a potential turning point for human spirituality, which is if we can really recognize that the deep wisdom of the past may not be sufficient, but the sort of, you know, pick and choose pop spirituality of the present may also not be sufficient, I think it forces us to ask this question, which is how can we give birth to authentic spiritual traditions, like a new authentic wisdom tradition that's really sourced from the depths of spiritual enlightenment, of deep practice and realization, but is not a holdover from an old mythic worldview, is really something genuinely tuned to and suited to the challenges of our time, our unique new kind of human capacities that we've evolved for deeper self-awareness and interiority and relationship that really meets us where we are and gives us a path into the future. And there are a number of people pursuing this now, you know, with a lot of vigor, and it's a very exciting time. And that's what motivated me to want to create this series, to feature a lot of the people who I feel are doing leading edge work in this and get us all together really thinking about it. And I'm just so thrilled that we've got 7,000 people joining us in this inquiry. We have a Facebook forum now where you can all jump in and into the dialogue. We've already got 500 members, and I'm expecting that to go up because we just launched it. So I could go on about this for hours, as is probably apparent, but right now I want to talk with Michael Murphy and hear what he has to say about it all. So for those of you who don't know Mike, the name Michael Murphy is almost synonymous with the notion of exploring our higher human potential. Many people regard Michael as one of the founding fathers of the human potential movement itself. He's the chairman of Esalen Institute, which he co-founded with Richard Price in 1962 and has done pioneering work for now nearly five decades into all aspects of human transformation. He's been profiled in The New Yorker, featured in magazines and journals worldwide. In terms of Mike's own influences, he, after graduating from Stanford University, he studied at the Sri Aurobindo Ashram in South India, where he really developed the spiritual and philosophical foundations that led to the founding of Esalen and have guided the rest of his career. In the 1980s, he helped organize Esalen's pioneering Soviet-American exchange program, which became a premier vehicle for citizen-to-citizen relations between Russians and Americans. And in 1989, Boris Yeltsin's first visit to America was initiated by Esalen. So I'll list a few of his many books. He is the author of many nonfiction books that explore the evidence for extraordinary human capacities, including The Future of the Body, The Life We Are Given, which he wrote with George Leonard, In the Zone, Transcendent Experience in Sports, and The Physical and Psychological Effects of Meditation. He's also written four novels, Golf in the Kingdom, which is now apparently on the verge of being made into a movie. I think they're shooting, as well as The Kingdom of Shiva's Irons, Jacob Adibet, and An End to Ordinary History. So our topic today is integral transformative practice and the evolution of the whole person. And so with no further ado, I want to bring Mike onto the call and welcome you. And I'm so excited we're kicking off the series with you, Mike.
Good morning, Craig. That was a beautiful, very lucid summary of our present situation in regard to these subjects. So it was very good.
Thank you. Well, good. I thought you'd probably resonate with it all. Something we've talked about a lot in the past. So, just to kick off, Mike, just so people can get to know a little bit about you and how you came into all this. And you know, one thing you and I really deeply share is that we were both strongly impacted by Sri Aurobindo's work. And I'm wondering if you could just share a little bit about your own encounter with Sri Aurobindo, how that impacted the course of your life. And maybe even what it is about Sri Aurobindo that really set his vision apart from the traditional sort of Indian spiritual matrix in which he arose.
I first heard the name from my professor at Stanford. I was just a sophomore there, 19 years old. That's quite a while ago, in 1950. Frederick Spiegelberg was the great professor, and in a course of comparative religious studies, he ended it with Sri Aurobindo and the Life Divine, after having taken a survey of the great traditions, starting with the Vedas and the Upanishads, and then in the great contemplative traditions of all the great religions, ended with Ramakrishna as the avatar of, you know, the deep core of the perennial wisdom in all the traditions, this, you know, tremendous genius of Ramakrishna, and then Aurobindo. I went home the summer after that course and read The Life Divine and came back and eventually dropped out of the pre-med track I was on and out of my fraternity, and Anyway, I spent the last 2 years at Stanford strengthening my inquiries into what Sri Aurobindo opened up for me. Now, the thing that differentiated Aurobindo from everything else in that first course on comparative religious studies that I was in at 19, the signature feature was his embedding of the great perennial wisdoms in the facts, or the fact of evolution, that the cosmos itself is in this stupendous unfoldment, and everything has to be seen in the light of that fact. And with that, he presented an integral vision of interiority and work in the world, and it was a vision of things that required, and I think one way to put this, Craig, is that personal and social and physical and every dimension is mutually entailed in the other. Yes, you can focus in one or another aspect of our very complex being, but what is neglected always comes back to get you. In some sense, Freud's doctrine of the return of the repressed. If we repress the physical side of our nature, it will return to insist, well, knock on the door, and it must be listened to. Vice versa, if we suppress the contemplative mystical, it'll haunt us in our dreams, and however. So anyway, that sense of the evolutionary adventure and the notion of the integral fired me up more than anything else. And as the years have gone by, Craig, Aurobindo gets better and better for me, even though I become more and more critical of certain aspects of his vision, too. So that's something we might want to talk about. If Sri Aurobindo were alive today, he would be questioning some aspects of his own vision. Indeed, that's what he did throughout most of his life. Anyway, that's a first broad brush, a couple of remarks, Craig, on what is a very, very big subject for me of the centrality of Sri Aurobindo and my own inspiration.
Well, that's great, and I think maybe we can kind of circle back around into some of what you were bringing up there at the end as we move forward. I kind of want to ask how, because the other, obviously the thing I think many people would know you for, apart from the many, probably hundreds of thousands of golfers who've written you about their spiritual experiences on the golf course,
right,
for your Golf in the Kingdom series, but is really, you know, the fact that you have been such a pioneer through Esalen Institute, which itself can almost be seen as probably one of the first and, you know, greatest experiments in what we're talking about now, which is evolving the spiritual path, attempting to come up with a Western wisdom tradition in a sense. So looking back on the 5 decades almost of the Esalen experiment, what would you say has been the great learning or great learnings that stand out for you today?
Well, there have been several, Craig. I mean, for one thing, Esalen provided the place, the venue for an awful lot of practices and ideas that were unknown, relatively unknown in the West, say in the 60s and 70s. It provided a place for them to get known. We were probably the main place, certainly in the United States, for the advent of somatic practices, you know, everything from sensory awareness and Charlotte Silver, that became a great base for her, Rolfing, the Feldenkrais method, all of that. The field of somatics, Don Johnson, perhaps more than anyone, has given philosophical basis to it as a field. If it is a field, it would be a field in the sense that Hatha Yoga is a field in India. Hatha Yoga comprises God knows how many hundreds or perhaps thousands of approaches and techniques. The same now with somatics. But in any case, Esalen provided a place for a primary place for that, and it did so as well for a number of crossover approaches that began as therapy and ended up as ways of increasing emotional awareness, emotional intelligence, and so forth. For example, Gestalt therapy, Esalen became the operating base for Fritz Perls, and who got to be famous when he was living at Esalen, and Gestalt therapy spread all over the place, not primarily at Esalen as a way of symptom cure, not as a medical procedure, but as a way of self-cultivation, self-inquiry, and opening up into what Fritz Perls called authenticity. There were a number of approaches like that that you could say were therapies, but they really are kind of emotional yogas, yogas of the psyche. Psychosynthesis was one of Roberto Assagioli. And then in other fields, I mean, we really did provide a place for a lot of meditation teachers who had not been known at all. I believe we were the first organization to give a grant to Tarthang Tulku. That was back in 66 or 67 and so forth, and got to know so many of the wonderful Buddhist and Hindu teachers that came over. So we Esalen has been a meeting place, a convener of practitioners and theorists, and to show that we as modern people can look at all these approaches in a free and independent spirit. And one of our main aims was not to let anyone capture the flag. In other words, keep it in open exploration. Now, what you said earlier, Craig, about, you know, the pitfalls of the cafeteria mentality, I am well aware of that. Esalen, however, I think has an authentic mission to be a small college, a meeting place where these new openings can be viewed. But one of the great learnings is that the cafeteria mentality doesn't work. So many people through the years, 10,000 people a year come there. We've been going for 48 years. There have been hundreds of thousands of people through that. The many satoris, the illuminations, the great enthusiasms that happen down there regularly. If they come on a weekend, sometimes they take root and last, but most frequently they start to wear out by Tuesday. If you came on Friday and you left Sunday, by Tuesday some of the enthusiasm was worn off. Maybe your new resolutions have been ground down by your family, who thinks maybe you're getting a little overexcited, etc. And out of all of that, It deepened our appreciation that the only way to explore into these tremendous vistas that are there for us is through long-term, dedicated practice. And that led George Leonard and I to start our own Integral Transformative Practice, ITP, in 1992. Now these groups are going in various places, a new one in Moscow, in different parts of the United States, and so forth, but a part of the inspiration for that was the need, first, for long-term practice, secondly, the integral. Now, that was another, I think, great learning, not just for those of us in the center of Esalen, but for the community of inquirers and explorers that has emerged over these last decades in all around the world, really, and that is that I would call it the integral imperative. In other words, you can't escape the integral. I'd like to say that after we started ITP, and I'd been a longtime practitioner of meditation and physical fitness and so forth, but one of the things it taught me is, yes, I appreciate the integral, but I didn't know I was going to have to be this integral.
And Mike, can you
go?
Mike, can you also tell us a little bit more about what you mean by the word integral and take us into that?
Okay, the integral,
some folks,
yeah,
listening, yeah, it'll be a new concept for, so, yeah.
It will or won't be?
For some folks, it will be, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so. Well, the integral now, you know, Craig, words, you know, there should be a hospital and a rehabilitation center for certain words. They need to be refreshed. And there should be a cemetery as well. And, for example, you know, an awful lot of people have stopped, you know, including a lot of Buddhist teachers, using the word enlightenment so freely because it gets, so it means different things to different people. And that's happening already to integral. It means a variety of things. But first and foremost for us, what we say as a shorthand in our ITP practice, body, mind, heart, and soul, that's one shorthand. In other words, it must embrace our bodies, our emotional life in all its levels and lines of development, our minds, and everything that we might say is soul. Those levels and depths of consciousness that are emerging in the human race. But it also has to embrace both individual transformation and social transformation in the human sense and the nurturance of our physical world through all the work of ecology and sustainability. So that's in a very broad brush what integral means. It implies integration. For us in ITP, however, it doesn't mean cloning. When you get very doctrinaire images of what integral means, you can have an integral fundamentalism. We have to have this rest on the autonomy of the individual as well as the our fundamental embeddedness in this vast coevolution of souls in this complex physical cosmos. All of that goes together, but the principle of autonomy, which I think you were applying, has emerged with a huge new impulse in the modern world. We could talk about that, Craig. I mean, it got a huge burst in Periclean Athens, it got another gigantic one in the Renaissance. It was furthered but with the advent of science, and now modern psychodynamics, our understanding of how we are stunted often by our the cultures in which we're developed. Every culture reinforces certain aspects of human nature and neglects or suppresses others. These sorts of learnings have come like a great cascade over these last few hundred years. And the development of different cultures, for example, when I was at the Sri Aurobindo Ashram, the teacher there, the mother at the ashram, kept saying, you Westerners have to learn to surrender your ego, and most of the Indians here have to learn to develop more ego. There she was in the center of Sri Aurobindo's teaching, recognizing cultural differences in our ego development, in our psychological development, and so forth. So that advent of self-understanding and the development of the individual is a huge new component of everything we might call transformative practice or spiritual practice. And it this is my, you know, my most ambitious book, The Future of the Body, is kind of anchored in that notion, and we could talk about that. But in any case, all these things are implied for me in what is meant as the integral. Now, I do think we should hold up also the problems that some people have with that word integral. For example, in Russia, I and my wife Dulcie spent a lot of time over in Russia. Future of the Body has just been translated into Russian. And they've long had, Craig, you know, the doctrine of Tselnaya Lichnost, the integral personality, Russian philosophers, Solovyov and Berdyaev. It's there in Dostoevsky, celebrated this notion. And what they meant was the combination of the physical, the rational, and the mystical. And they felt that Russia, because it stood between the East and the West, would be the great mediator of Tsarnaya Lichnos. Well, that idea was taken over by the Communist Party and was sold to the populace in a way that has made many Russians sick and tired of the word integral, Tsarnaya Lichnos. Huh. So I keep saying to people, the integral connotes a vast expanse of human possibility, not a closure, not a cloning. It's a door opener with a premium on integration and opening to our many dimensions and an embrace of these. So I think with that proviso, anyway, this is going to require more hours of conversation here, Craig.
Okay, anyway. We've just decided to extend the call till 5 p.m. Just kidding.
So anyway, body, Mike, mind, heart, and soul, personal and social transformation.
Yeah, well, and let me jump into on something you brought up there that I'd just like to drill into a little bit. You were speaking about this, I think you call it the autonomy principle that's emerged, you know, this really new level of autonomy, of agency, self-possessed, being more self-aware, having more interiority. Now, many people have commented on what we might call sort of the sort of postmodern spiritual predicament, what Ken Wilber dubbed boomeritis, which I'm sure you're familiar with, which is this, and this will just be a simplified version of it, but which basically points to the fact that because we're now so self-possessed, so self-aware, so self-absorbed, so self-oriented by and large in our lives, that it's made it, you know, very difficult to engage in an authentic spiritual practice and gain really authentic transformative results, which, you know, traditionally would have been conceived as transcendence of ego, really being able to go beyond ourselves in a profound way, discover a context greater than ourselves, surrender to that greater context, live our lives for something bigger, and really, you know, discover a ground of being that's deeper than us. And yet I'm interested, part of what I'm interested in general with Integral Enlightenment and with this whole series is starting to look at, okay, we can see that this is a problem on one hand for the spiritual life, is this ego, this strong ego, this strong postmodern Western ego that we have. On the other hand, how might we turn that into a strength on the spiritual path? How might we leverage our newfound autonomy, our newfound self-awareness and interiority to actually accelerate our spiritual development and take it to new heights? And I get the sense this is something you've thought about in constructing ITP and in all of what you're doing. So I want to just hear your thoughts on that question.
Well, that's a great question, Craig. You know what you're doing with this series? You are really framing the conversation we really, really need to have, the world needs to have. And immediately with what you're doing, these gigantic questions leap right up, and it's what we should be addressing. It's what I am in my own work, what I want Esalen to do in ITP. And this one, of course, is front and center. So just to begin an answer, first, when you look at that critique, you know, the boomeritis critique, you've got to remember that's for some people. There are an awful lot of people who come through Esalen Institute who have an opposite problem. They haven't gotten to that stage. They are still finding out things that my parents didn't know about. There are really different levels and kinds of and lines of development. You know, you're quoting Ken. I mean, Ken has really been careful to make that point, too. There are different lines of development, different levels of development, and this is true. So the boomeritis critique applies to a certain cohort of people. And I think if you're going to talk in very general terms, you've got to realize, be self-reflexive, who do you hang out with most of the time? you know? And I would say that the overwhelming number of folks I hang out with would be post-boomeritis, people who are very involved in the works of the world, who are really strong players. But I know exactly what you're talking about in boomeritis by a certain cohort that appears at Esalen Institute, for example. But there's also the cohort that are still struggling with issues of freeing themselves from, you know, all sorts of imprisonments and misalignments with their deep self. So anyway, that's number one. Okay, in ITP, what George and I have told ourselves and everybody involved in this is it's a householder's path, which means that you're going to have all sorts of living arrangements. This is a community of people who are not going to live in a full-time Buddhist monastic situation. In other words, we're going to live like most humans on the planet live, but have sufficient closeness to one another so that we can reinforce our practice. I think one of the great challenges is constructing communities that have the elasticity and yet sufficient closeness so that we nurture and encourage one another, support one another, challenge one another, hold up the mirror to one another, and have a big red flag up against this tendency in a lot of people to become a top sergeant and reinforce a quick superego response, and all the shoulds come in. You should be doing this. Hey, big guy, who's saying should to me, you know? And I have seen this as a tremendous problem. How to keep an open, thriving, coherent, mutually supportive community going without the foreclosures? Am I making sense, Craig, on this?
Yeah, you are to me. I mean, I definitely want to make sure we're making it accessible to everyone. Maybe if you can unpack it a little bit further, too.
Yeah. Okay, I would argue that in every population, there are a certain amount of people born to be a top sergeant. That is, not to lead like the general or the captain, but to enforce their readings of what the captain said. And I encountered this very, very strongly when I lived at the Sri Aurobindo Ashram in 1955 and 56. And the Aurobindo community, in the name of this stupendous genius, Sri Aurobindo, has given rise to various normative, I would say, groups and constellations of ideas that is quick to exclude new green shoots of thought and so forth. In other words, and this happens in so many communities, when so many of these cults formed, as you remember in the 70s, you have, you know, all degrees of pathology like Jim Jones at Jamestown. That would be one great extreme mm-hmm. of a cult in which the leader finally tells everyone to commit suicide, and virtually all of them commit suicide. Then you come over to ones in which it becomes the norm to have an extremely, quote, in quote, liberated sexuality, which means that you have to have many sexual partners, and then that's enforced. And now, in the days of great sexual liberation in the 70s and all of this in the 60s, to me, you know, this it went far, far too far. You can choose almost any activity and make it normative in a tightly self-involved community. That's what we don't need. We need awareness of how this can happen in groups. Now, not only do we have to be aware of how that can happen around very pathological or very destructive forms of expression, but also how a community can subtly foreclose on certain new developments in a person's psyche, certain emergent items, because they are strange, are therefore rejected. Now,
they don't conform to the kind of presumed kind of cultural matrix or belief system of the community, so they're just rejected, and
that's
so
you're right.
Autonomy gets suppressed. On the one hand, community can really serve as a powerful catalyst and container for our transformation.
Right.
On the other hand, it can suppress certain aspects of our individual development that might need a little more room
That's
to
right.
roam.
Yeah. I mean, one example of this is in the there's been such an influence for the good by the Vedanta and the many Buddhist groups that have taught us about meditation and contemplation and contemplative wisdom and those forms of enlightenment that they celebrate, but at the same time suppress the notion of siddhis. That is the supernormal powers that emerge often in the practice of yoga. And there's been quite a cottage industry now in contemporary religious studies showing that the tantra, in the broad sense of tantra, that, in other words, the doctrine that the divine is both immanent in the world and transcendent to it, the tantra always gives more privilege or more place to the siddhis than many of the schools that aim at the ultimate, what is they call the ultimate enlightenment. So when you have a practice community, and I've known some of these communities, the people who start meditating a lot suddenly start developing telepathic powers, psychokinetic powers, all sorts of things, and these are often discouraged in these communities. Now, the new study of Tantra shows that where it spread from India to Tibet to China and Japan, and now into the United States, Jeff Kripal, the very eminent professor of religious studies, did the big book on Esalen, has argued that in the 1960s there was an inflection in the United States and Europe from the Vedanta influence of Indian studies to the Tantra. Now, this is another subject for discussion here, but nevertheless, with the Tantra comes a new appreciation of the complexity of realization, the powers that emerge in practice that are often suppressed in religious communities. Now, we don't have to belabor this, but the point, again, here is that in a community of practice that is eliciting great things, other great things arise that are then suppressed. Now, if I can make a leap, Craig, here, there's an analogy for me that I've discovered in many fields of everyday activity that are much celebrated in practice. Let's take sport. In the world of sport, there has been the emergence of physical prodigies such as the world has never seen. And all the sports are giving rise to record-breaking at an astonishing speed of record-breaking if you track it like I do. Okay, but people are not in it primarily for spiritual transformation. Let's say in the world of golf, there are these super athletes, Tiger Woods foremost among them, who want to be better golfers. But in the process of doing that, suddenly start having these amazing illuminations. And I've learned a lot about that through this book, Golf in the Kingdom, I wrote. Their coaches and fellow teammates back in the 70s thought these guys were half-cracked. And they didn't get a lot of support for it. But over the last 30 years, this whole idea of in the zone, it's emerged. And now let's say half the pros on the PGA Tour have sports psychologists who acknowledge these extraordinary moments of clarity and have started, I would call it, an elementary yoga of inner inquiry and self-cultivation to enhance the golf game. Now, it's almost a mirror image of the spiritual communities that suppress, let's say, all sorts of strange powers that emerge when you're meditating. On the other side, the golfers or the athletes are not valuing what emerges on the spiritual side of the intensity with which they practice their sport. So you can look at, I would say, any field of activity that requires lifelong dedication. I've talked to doctors, great surgeons, great musicians, where you have a tradition of thousands and thousands of hours of practice, you have this covert emergence of supernormal capacities. We need to form integral communities that are hip to all this and know how to deal with it and honor and acknowledge these emergent capacities in all of us that are, I would say, the limbs and organs of our emerging supernature. We are all creatures of this powerfully advancing cosmos. We're here precisely to evolve. We need a picture of human nature that is big enough and deep enough to understand these emergent capacities and then practices to encourage their development and let them find their place in your particular developing wholeness. Craig, I'm sorry, I covered
no, it's great,
a lot of ground there.
Fascinating stuff. And maybe just to so to kind of try to tie some of that back and bring it to the kind of the pinpoint of our conversation here. So what would you say as you when you sort of look at that broad context I laid out at the beginning about this need to really start to evolve an authentic wisdom tradition that's not in any way disrespectful to the wisdom of the past, that takes everything it can from the wisdom of the past that still applies, but that's really oriented toward where we are now, what we understand about the human condition now, and what we are all feeling is this new impulse to really be conscious participants in the evolutionary process, and to the sense that I can actually help move this forward through my participation. And I'm just curious, with all of your look research into emergent capacities, what you're calling the emergence of superordinary capacities in humanity, and the sense that that's accelerating, and all of your everything you've kind of brought up until now about the need for a more integral or holistic approach, what do you see as the sort of trajectory that we need to take, that spirituality at its leading edge,
yeah,
because obviously there's different,
right,
you know, different dimensions, but spirituality,
right,
at its leading edge needs to take.
Right. Well, you know, Craig, I ask myself this question constantly. So does my board of trustees at Esalen ask me this question.
Good.
Where do we go with all this? So do the leaders of ITP. This is a question that's up for a number of us, and you're framing it beautifully, you know, in your own writings, of course, and in this conversation we're having right now. There are countless ways we can all help out. One way I frame a first answer to certainly to the Esalen board and to the ITP board is that there are four large tasks immediately ahead of us. First, to keep developing what we affectionately call the big vision. What is the whole metaphysical cosmology we need to develop? The overarching philosophy of it. It has to be big enough to embrace all of this. And Esalen's actually got a series of programs on the philosophy of the all, you know, that we're working on. Secondly,
Before you go to number two, can you tell me a little bit more about number one? Because I got really interested when you were saying what's your sense of that? Can you give me the elevator version of it?
Well, this is a conversation, Craig. I mean, you know, there's so many people coming in at different angles right now. This is hot,
yeah.
Because there are a number of people asking this question as you have, you know, proposing we're in a new axial age. Obviously, there are certain things that this must be rooted in the ever-developing, rapidly developing story of evolution. I love every week to say, what have I learned this week about evolution, you know, in the different levels? If you want to, you can learn something new every day. You read, you know, and we can go into the hot zones of this picture that's being revealed to the human race. We sit in the middle of one of the greatest revelations. It's probably, well, it's certainly up there with any great moment in world history, but this is the moment of all moments. This is a moment of kairos in the Greek sense, in which chronos, you know, the ordinary time, is giving way to this grand disclosure. We're learning about the story of evolution, not just the evolution of star systems or of species on Earth, but the evolution of human consciousness and human culture, and then those attempts to put it all together. People like Teilhard de Chardin, Aurobindo, Whitehead, you know, that, and learn more about that story. So it has to rest in that. Then it has to rest in the kind of psychology that William James and Frederick Myers represented, the exploration of the vast reaches of the subliminal mind, and what I've tried to do, you know, in the future of the body, to show that every human attribute which has arisen out of our animal ancestors gives rise to a tremendous array of supernormal expressions. That's what Future of the Body is about, giving some order to this and showing that the thousands of siddhis, supernormal powers, the charisms of the Catholic Church, in every tradition, all of them can be seen in the light of a developmental sequence. So the vision side must be big enough to accommodate all this. But there's also then, Craig, three other things that have to happen for this to come to birth. Second, obviously, are the forms of practice. Now, the integral idea has emerged very strongly, I would say, since the early 90s, and has been furthered certainly by my work, by Ken Wilber, George Leonard, and I, and many people now are really seeing that you've got to put this stuff together in a way that brings our complexity into a new coherence, and particularly with what's emergent in us, what's going beyond our ordinary functioning, and we've got to break out beyond the traditions. The traditions, and you said it beautifully earlier in this conversation, emerged before we even knew about evolution in the cosmic contemporary sense, and therefore, even their greatest disclosures, and the greatest disclosures we have about our spiritual depths, have come out of these traditions. You can't get past Atman and Brahman. I mean, you find that in the Upanishads. That's been instantiated among enough opinion elites in the world for 2,500 years. The Buddhists gave new articulations to this, had their own slants. Then Buddhism itself fragmented into hundreds of schools. So the vast diamond with its countless aspects of that revelation has been disclosed to the human race and so forth. Okay, but that was not framed in terms of a cosmos that was evolving. And so practices have to break out and, like vision, be big enough and elastic enough and open enough to accommodate this huge daimon that drives us, this great dimension of the human spirit. And then third, I just got to say, Craig, here, I think we must accompany this by a rich embrace of research. With our ITP groups, we keep research programs going, asking, how are we doing? How's this going? Is it working or not working? George Leonard and I fully embrace the notion, if something's not working, modify it or drop it. And then fourthly, again, we have to build and experiment with and develop institutional and community support for this that, again, is elastic enough and smart enough to so that we can encourage one another without thwarting one another. So anyway, these four aspects are crucial. Now, the vision, the practice, the research, the community institutional building. Now, that's one way I have of talking to various groups about what we can do. Now, each of us brings something unique to the party. And so we have a big field to work in here.
Mike, that was beautiful. I just have to say my heart was singing when you were laying out the vast evolutionary context and how it's waking up in humanity. And, so that was great. Really,
well,
really
whenever
rich.
You and I get together, we should just start singing.
We got to hang out together more now that I'm in the Bay Area.
Yeah, that's a deal.
Great. Well, Mike, at this juncture in the seminar, what I want to do is turn and open it up for some questions from the vast sea of participants who are joining us online and by phone. I want to first try and take a few online because it's going to be a little easier, I think. So I think that'll warm us up before we tackle the technical challenge of taking questions on the conference call, which I think we'll succeed at as well. But for anybody who has a question for Mike, simply send us your question via instant message in the little teleseminar Q&A window on your computer. Go ahead and start sending your questions now, and I'm going to just say a couple words from our sponsors. We're not going to commercial break. I'm just going to share a little bit with you about some of the folks who've sponsored this series. One of them is Enlighten Next magazine, the magazine that can give you an entirely different perspective on just about everything. I'm biased because I was editor of that magazine for 8 years when it was called What is Enlightenment, but I think everybody will agree it's a fantastic magazine. And you can pick up a free digital issue at enlightennext.org/free magazine. That's enlightennext, two N's in the middle, enlightennext.org/free magazine. And there's a link to that, by the way, in one of the emails you received, and there will be more links to come. But, yeah, get a free digital issue from them. Also want to tell you about Next Step Integral. They're inviting you to their Integral Education Seminar this August. That's nextstepintegral.org. If you're anywhere in the education field and you want to learn about how to bring a more integral perspective to bear on your work, that would be a fantastic event to attend at nextstepintegral.org. And also just want to mention that Big Mind is just announcing a new retreat this August called Enlightenment and the Western Mind, an exploration and demonstration of the territory and practices of awakening. And you can learn all about that at vastsky.org, vastsky.org. And in each of these events, I'm going to just mention a few of the sponsors so you can get a sense of what they're doing. I encourage you to click on all the links in the emails and on the website to check them out because they've been a great support in making this happen for free. So at this point, I'm going to open us up for some questions. I'm going to take a look and see what has emerged on the Q&A section here, see what we've got. Okay, we're going to take one from Beijing, China. It appeals to our global perspective here. This is from Joey asking the four quadrants. So he's asking about Wilberian Wilberian sort of post-metaphysics here. The four quadrants seem to be archetypal fields of force, and indeed we can use the quadrants as archetypal information for a transformation in our life. Is there an integral practice that makes specific use of the quadrants as archetypal forms? Mike, is that one you can take, or is that a little too specific into Wilberian structure for this? What do you think?
Well, you know, I would need to know what Joey means by archetypal. You know, again, it's used in so many ways, you get apples and oranges here. Ken's framework is primarily epistemological. It's how we need to proceed toward deeper understanding, you know, that we have to be, you know, we're all, you know, many of us are very familiar with Ken's work. But when you talk about archetypes, you're getting, for me, it's more ontology. It's like archetypes as it's normally used, certainly from a Jungian perspective, but if you're a Platonic or Neoplatonic or in some of the more, you know, New Age ways, it's used, those are big somethings, powers, forces, whatever. So I don't know. I'd have to say that question's above my pay grade.
Okay, well, the good news is we've got Ken Wilber himself on the show, on the seminar next week, so we'll have a chance.
How he would deal with that. Hey, I love it that your first question is from Beijing.
Yeah, me too. It was a little technical, but I grabbed it just for the global.
No, it brings up something I didn't say, Craig,
please,
which
is
that the integral is driven to a large extent because we are truly now global citizens. You know, certainly to live here in Marin County, you cannot escape the Buddhist or Sufi influence, really. Mm-hmm. And all of us, you know, raised Christian or Jewish, maybe, you know, 95% of us, but so many people now who don't go to church or don't go to temple anymore, but who sit at Zen Center or Spirit Rock or in the Tibetan groups or Hamid's group or Faisal Mukadan's group or whatever, you cannot escape it. And that is a tremendous challenge, but it's also immensely liberating because it brings in all these wonderful perspectives. So very appropriate that your first question here is from Beijing. I love it.
Well, since you mentioned Marin County, we'll take one from Richard in Mill Valley. He is asking, is it realistic to hope for a shift in the predominant worldview regarding human interactions from competitive to cooperative? In other words, is it realistic to hope that we might be able to make that shift as a species? And I'm going to add one on that, which is, and if so, how long do you think it'll take us?
Well, you know, I've long since given up on prophesying timelines. People started asking me that question after Esalen had been going about 10 years. You know, we were much in the news, and people say, how long for this and how long for that? So many things have come on much faster than I thought, and other things much, much slower. So I don't know on the timeline. But, yes, I think it's very realistic to say that the cooperative is emergent. We're being driven to it as well as attracted to it. This is, again, one we could spend hours and hours on this. But the mad selfishness of the recent, evident in the recent financial meltdown, you know, this hugely competitive thing with these financial derivatives. Mm. Warren Buffett says, look out for geeks bearing formulas, you know.
Right.
Beware Greeks being bearing gifts. You know, all this bad debt we've sold to the world, coming out of this highly competitive financial institutions on Wall Street and so forth. And they're, you know, the same with the whole global warming. We're watching the disasters caused by this hyper-competitive culture. So that's the stick. And then there's the carrot of, you know, that how much better life can be for all of us at all levels through developing warmer and smarter communities. And I would say we've got to appreciate the tremendous gifts that have come out of the therapeutic revolution, that with all the excesses of certain psychotherapies, there have been the great gift of showing that we can modify our relationships with one another and not harbor the grudges that, that I saw so often in my parents' and grandparents' generations, you know, grudges that were carried in families forever in small towns across the land and so forth. So there's a lot to make me hopeful. But this is an adventurous world, Craig, filled with dangers, and nothing's been promised. You know, if we get metaphysical about the why of things, I would say, it's not over till it's over. The game, we're in the game, And it's up to us to nurture the good. And it ain't going to happen unless we all get in there and work at it. But there's a lot of reason for hope, I think. That's my gut answer.
Yeah, me too. I think when we look at the long trajectories of evolution, as Robert Wright pointed out in Non-Zero or John Stewart in Evolution's Arrow, there is this trajectory toward greater and greater cooperation.
Yeah.
I mean, when we look at the current situation, it might look a long ways off, but if we can step
right
back again to that 30,000-foot view, we're actually, as a species, a lot further ahead than we used to be. And I think now with this impulse awakening to try to really consciously move the dial, I can't prophesy
absolutely
when either, but I think we'll get there. So, but I like
absolutely
your caveat that we'll only get there if we make it happen.
No, we're not. This is not a predetermined universe. This is an adventurous. It's an adventure embedded in a profound mystery, but it's filled with grace. This is a universe filled with grace, and if we work, and these graces will be given. And anyway,
nice.
So,
all right. Well, we're gonna take one now from Houston, Texas. Mani Subramanian, I hope I pronounced your name right, asking, I thought meditation leads us into the path to achieve our full potential as a human being. Once we get connected to the source, anything and everything is achievable. Please explain why integral transformation cannot be achieved through meditation and getting connected to God. Now, I think what we're hearing is why meditation alone is not sufficient, because this person's saying, well, it seems to me that it should be. And what are your thoughts about that? Because you've obviously, your whole development of integral transformative practice is in many ways a response to a question just like this, I would say, right?
Well, you know, that for me and for many of us is born by witnessing so many meditation communities that give rise to so much violence and pathological behavior. And the turn that many teachers, Buddhist and Hindu teachers, for example, have taken towards psychotherapy. Wonderful pioneers, say, for example, Jack Kornfield, who established Spirit Rock and is one of America's leading Vipassana teachers, has brought in psychotherapeutic insights. He's worked a lot with Stan Grof, and that's partly out of opportunity and partly out of necessity that we have to deal with our shadow side in practice often. Meditation can reinforce our weaknesses. If a person has extreme problems relating to other people and finds a kind of solitary satisfaction in meditation, it sometimes leads a person further away from creative social relationships. Or if a person has some chronic physical problems, they can be reinforced by just if you sit, 8 hours a day in the lotus position, certain communities develop an awful lot of lower back problems. So they take up various stretching exercises. Now, that impulse toward the integral was deeply embedded in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. I would say the drive toward the integral can be found everywhere, even in very ascetic communities that violated the principle of the integral. But I would say it's time for us to call the contemplative life back to its deeply integral impulse. And this was the great at the center of Sri Aurobindo's teaching. He felt that the Vedic period in India was essentially integral and put a big premium on the physical life, the life of community and relationships. And his yoga, his integral yoga, was in large part a call back to what he saw embedded in the earliest sources of Indian spirituality. In that sense, he was a very deep Indian patriot. Indeed, he was jailed by the British. He was the first Indian independence leader to call for full independence. He was the first one to use it along with Tilak and some others. But in other words, out of the Indian tradition, he found the principle of the Purna Advaita, the integral impulse. So it's what can happen in meditation that leads it astray. It can lead to fullness. It's how it's used. It's how it's understood. It's how it's reinforced in a community of practice. So anyway, that's my answer.
Fantastic. Thanks. And thanks to everyone who instant messaged in your questions. I think we only got to about 1% of the questions. So I would encourage you to put your questions up on our Facebook discussion board and let everybody join in the dialogue there, because there's a lot already getting started. And what we're going to try and do now is take a few live questions on the phone. And I say try just because I've never done a conference call this large, and I know sometimes it can get a little tricky technologically. So let's see how it goes. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to change the setting here. I'm going to make it so that you can unmute and mute yourself. Right now everybody's just muted, so there's no background noise, but I'm going to do a little switch. Now you're going to be able to press *6 to unmute yourself, but only do that if I... And the way I'm going to do this to try to contain it is ask for a question from someone who lives in a particular region of the world or the country, so we can, you know, limit the number of people trying to ask a question at once. So here I go. Hold on tight.
All callers are unmuted. All callers are muted and may unmute themselves by pressing *6.
Okay, so hang tight. Don't unmute yet. So let's take a question from someone in a region we haven't heard from. How about the... somewhere in the Northeast, so either in New York or New England. If you live in that area and you want to ask Mike a question, go ahead and press *6 and say your name and the city you're from. And then I'll kind of call on someone and we'll go from there. So I probably have to wait a sec to see if there's anybody out there in the Northeast. You got too busy into your afternoons already and... left us behind. Okay, let's try anywhere in the Midwest of the U.S. Press *6 and say your name and the city you're from.
Stuart.
Stuart. And where are you from? We'll take you, Stuart.
Vermont.
Oh, okay. We got the Northeast after all. Great. Okay, so anyone else who tried to jump in, just go ahead and press *6 again, and that'll remute you, and we'll just talk with Stuart, and then maybe you can come in again later. So, Stuart, what's your question?
I am very much enjoying the conversation, but I find maybe I am naive or immature in this, but I would like to know some more concrete methods or steps by which we can enjoy and appreciate this new integral thinking.
Mike, it's in your hands.
Greg. Stuart, thank you. I first refer you to the very nice summaries that Craig gave toward the beginning, and then those announcements of these various activities. You know, Enlightenment Next magazine, I think, is a wonderful way in to this field. To pick up issues of that magazine.
Enlighten Next. Enlighten Next.
Enlighten Next. Go to Ken Wilber's websites. What would be the best access, Craig, into Ken's websites there?
Well,
there's a couple of them.
I would send you to, particularly in light of your question, Stuart, which is very much about the practical side of it. In terms of the Wilber world, I would send you to integrallife.com. I'm just making sure it's a .com. Well, let me just take a quick peek here. Yeah, it's integrallife.com. So,
and another one, Stuart, would be to go to esalen.org. That's Esalen Institute. They have a website, and advertise a wide variety of programs and ways into personal inquiry through that, through the programs there. We do about 500 different seminars a year into this territory. So those are some first suggestions.
Sure, and Mike, don't forget to promote your ITP site, which is itp-life.com, which gives you a very comprehensive approach to what Mike and George Leonard have developed in terms of integral transformative practice.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, itp-life.com.
It's a .com.
Yeah.
Now, Stuart, are we hitting your question, Stuart, or are we going a little different direction? I just want to make sure we're...
No, I believe you are. I'm trying to quickly make note of suggestions.
Okay. All right.
But, yeah, thank you.
And I'll refer you to my site, too, which is integralenlightenment.com, which has a lot of practice. It's a lot of practical, practice-oriented stuff on there, too, so that might be another place to take a look at.
Pardon
my shameless self-promotion. Go ahead.
Stuart, are you still there?
Yes.
Stuart, you know, one thing, if you do explore into these sites, you begin to see some patterns emerging you'll find right away, and one will refer to another. And, you know, there is, when you do that, I think you'll find, it's what I find at least, that there's a big something that's emerging. It's the beginnings of a culture, of a giant conversation, of a community of practice. No great sociologist or anthropologist yet has examined this in toto because it's so new, but it's a big something. And you'll see, I mean, as you explore around, you know, most of us know one another. When a community forms like this of inquiry, pretty soon people get to know one another in it. And even though there can be competition between groups, sometimes that serves the common good by bringing different aspects out. But with it all, there's a kind of coherence, I would argue, Craig. I don't know how you feel about
that. I completely agree. Yeah, I don't know who coined the term co-opetition, but I think it's a good one because we're all cooperating and competing at the same time, and I think it is.
Yeah, there's a kind
everyone.
Of unity in the diversity, but the diversity is a good thing.
Yeah. Well, let's grab another one. Thanks for your call, Stuart. So, Stuart,
Thank you.
Go ahead and press, you bet, and can you press *6 to remute your line? And then let's see if we've got anyone from either the Midwest or the Inner Mountain West, Colorado or anywhere out there that has a call. If so, press *6 to unmute and give me your name and where you're from.
Hello, this is Michael from Salt Lake City.
Great. Okay, so Michael, we'll take your call, and anyone else who was trying to jump in, go ahead and remute with a *6. And, yeah, Michael, go for it.
Well, it kind of goes to a little bit on the last answer, just the balance between this community and other communities, that where do you hold the balance between we're part of the solution and we're part of the problem, because every community that forms thinks they're the solution.
And you're
great
saying
question.
Great.
That is
yeah,
a great
Mike.
Question. Yeah, listen, that is very, very important. You know, George Leonard and I used to like to ask that same question. In other words, I think we just have to keep that question in front of us and answer it on a case-by-case basis, whether that case-by-case is in the realm of practice or in the realm of theory or of community building. That's why I think, Michael, that research is crucial. It's like on our grand canoe, we need the outrigger of research. That is people who are sufficiently detached from the activity that you're taking a look at, who studies and see how you're doing. What's the outcome of this? And then just holding that question up there. I think that's it's fundamental.
I mean, it's really easy to get into the arrogance of, well, if people would just be more like me.
Exactly. I mean, that's one of the great, great pitfalls of any aspiring practice. But, you know, at the same time, you have to have nerve, and you have to have courage. You have to have an entrepreneurial spirit to move forward. And, it's a great function when that can get lost if there's too much denigration of what is called, quote, the ego. In Greek psychology, thymos. Thymos was in Plato the white steed on the great chariot of human nature. You know, the driver was nous, the reason, and epithemia was the black steed. This is the lower, what Aurobindo called the lower vital. And a number of social historians have criticized post-Freudian psychology in the West of neglecting thymos. That is the, which goes for pride and nobility and honor. You know, we don't, these words are a little bit out of fashion now, you know, pride, honor, nobility. It's spirit. Sometimes we have spirit. But you need spirit and you need enterprise and you need the courage to stand and deliver if you're going to do anything in life of worth. At the same time, you can hold a kind of detached sense that, you know, I can speak out of my knowledge of Murphy's Law. If anything can fail, it will fail. I've learned that again and again and again in all communities of practice. But that doesn't mean you don't get up off the mat and try again. So, yes, that arrogance, when you say you're forging out onto the frontier, it can lead to arrogance, but it also can lead to discovery and to the advance of life. And that's what we have to do. We have to be spirited and self-reflexive and taking a look at ourselves at the same time.
Thank you.
Great answer, Mike. Yeah, thank you. Really appreciate your question. Go ahead and press *6 to remute your line. And I'm just going to take a shot here and see if anybody's on the call itself from Europe. I'm sure a lot of people are listening on the web. They may not be paying the long distance fees to be on the conference call. But if there is anyone from Europe, we'd love to hear from you. Press *6 to unmute your line and let us know your name and where you're from.
Hello, it's Elke from Berlin.
Hey, great. Got one. All right, thanks. So we'll
from
go ahead
Beijing
and take your call.
From Beijing to Berlin.
From Beijing to Berlin.
Yes.
I love it.
Okay. My question is, how does conscious evolution help to solve the big problems of the world?
How does conscious evolution help to solve the big problems of the world?
Yeah.
Great question. Mike, you want to?
Well, let me count the ways. First of all, when we say we expand consciousness, it would imply a deeper look at our shadow. That is, those parts of our nature that are hiding away from us, that are not fully in our awareness, that drive us often in very destructive ways. So consciousness expansion that includes more and more clarity about our shadow side, our destructive side. That in very broad terms is the first way. The second way is that it can show us more and more about our upside, about our tremendous capacities for joy and for love and for discovery. That's implicit in the expansion of consciousness. Thirdly, it can reveal the richness of who we are. You think of the liberation movements that I've lived through since the 60s, raising consciousness with civil rights. The American Civil Rights Movement, Martin Luther King, leads straight to Barack Obama. If America has an original sin, it was certainly, you'd have to say it was slavery. But we had to take a look at how profoundly racist we were, including a lot of us liberals, unconscious racism.
Right.
The same with gender issues. How recent is it that women it can be shown that women often do a much better job running these giant corporations than the boys' club has been. Sexual orientation, that it's not pathological to be gay. It can be a choice, a lifestyle choice, et cetera, et cetera. All the liberation movements that have shown we have a lot more room to move as individuals, and we don't have to wear the straitjackets that our little cultures put us into often. I could go on. One I have to say, though, is consciousness raising that embraces the mystery of the flesh. This has been, you know, Craig, one of the things we've not talked about in this conversation, but the capacity of the human body to experience life more deeply and to manifest the glories of our latent divinity is just coming up over the horizon of our understanding. Anyway, I wanted to get a word in for that. So consciousness expansion can go in many, many directions, has gone in many directions, will continue to go in many directions. That is not only to get us past our destructive side and get us out of these artificial prisons that we've been in, but to advance into these greater territories awaiting to be explored.
Well, I can't think of a better place to end our conversation, Mike. So we've just come to the end here. So Alka, was it? Thank you for your call from overseas. And Mike, thanks so much. This has been a complete delight. I'm so
well,
glad.
Craig,
so,
thank
so
you.
So excited
the
we
first
started.
Time, well, thank you. And first time I've ever been on a call like this that went from Beijing across America to Berlin. I'm impressed. Anyway, thank you very much, Craig.
Yeah, and Mike, just in terms of keeping up with you and your work, I want everyone to know where they can track you. We mentioned itp-life.com. Now, that's your ITP work. Are there any other aspects of what
well,
you're doing that you want to...
Esalen Institute, that's ESALEN.org. Esalen, ESALEN.org. That would be two places to start.
Okay, well, fantastic. So beautiful to talk with you, and let's do
Great,
it again
Craig.
Soon. Okay,
thank you very
so
much.
Now,
bye.
Bye-bye, Mike. Now, we're not quite done. Before I tell you all about next week's event, I want to just again let you know that we've launched our Facebook group. So if you're interested in diving into the conversation online, go to Facebook and search for Great Integral Awakening. Or just click on the link in the email that we sent you this morning, and that has a link to the Facebook group right in it. I also want to take a moment to thank our partners at Integral Life. To learn more about how you can participate in their profound integral work, visit integrallife.org. I must have done it wrong. I bet either one will get you there, but now I'm seeing it's integrallife.org. So I'm sure I got it wrong once. I'm not sure which time, and I can't quite track it right now. So either one, I'm sure, will get you there, and I'll get it right in the future. Okay. I also want to thank all the sponsors who've made all this possible, including Now and Zen, makers of the Zen Alarm Clock, iEvolve Global Practice Community, The Shift Movie, The New Feminine Power, Ursa Minor Arts and Media, who did such a fantastic job with the website as well as the Integral Enlightenment website. Really appreciated their support there. Also want to thank Enlighten Next, Next Step Integral, and Big Mind, all of whom have helped bring this to you for free. So next week, make sure you join us at the same time for Integral Spirituality, Embracing the Three Faces of God with Ken Wilber. Commonly referred to as the Einstein of consciousness, Ken will share his vast understanding of what it means to live an authentic spiritual life that is in touch not just with the perennial wisdom of enlightenment, but also with a contemporary understanding of the human condition. So we'll send you an event description and access codes for that event later this week. Until then, thanks so much for joining us, and keep evolving. Have a great week.
Conference recording has stopped.